I thought the same way, but it's kind of.
Seeing the time is now, it's 1:02 PM. Started my summer at the Ocala Police Department. I will call it order the quarterly meeting of the Ocala Police Officers Retirement System Board Trustees Meeting. Starting to my right, if we'll go around the room, everybody introduce themselves for purposes of the transcription.
Steve Cuffey. Doug Shively, Board Member.
Mindy Stewart, Board Member.
Brian Creedle, Board Member.
Larry Cole, Investment Consultant.
Martin LaPrey, Sawgrass Asset Management.
Lee Diener, Attorney.
Cindy Kelly, City of Ocala.
Dale Adams, Planning Administrator.
Justin Moore, Pension Specialist.
All right. First order of business will be a review of the prior minutes of the prior meetings. I believe Dale took them out about a week and a half ago. Any discussion in the minutes?
Move with step in there.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right, next thing will be approving retirement and drop benefits for Lisa Bianco and Chuck Long.
Okay, Lisa Bianco retired from the department on October the 10th after 25 years of service, 25 years and a day, in fact, and she has elected to take a retiree lifetime benefit with 100% continued to a joint annuity at the amount circled there on the form. A monthly payment to her as well as a joint annuity is $5,287.48 per month with no lump sum.
I move we accept the drop benefits for Lisa Bianco.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Is that motion to drop benefits? I think, did you say?
Or did retirement. You say
retirement? Well, I was going to say drop.
Did you say drop?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it should be retirement benefit. Oh, because she did not hear the drop, she actually retired.
Oh, I misunderstood, I'm sorry. Okay, I've changed my motion to approve retirement benefits for Lisa Bianco.
Okay.
Second.
Any discussion on that? All in favor?
Aye.
Get it right there.
Yeah.
I think she'd be disappointed if I called her up and said she had to come back. Participate in the draw.
Retire.
I think she has something to say about that.
I don't want to be on that call.
No, in fact, it was one of those, I don't want to work one extra day. That's why I was 25 years in a day.
I actually tried to get her to stay an extra year, and I showed her some things monetarily, and she's like, no.
Capital N, capital O.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With an exclamation point. Well, I'd like to sign those. Pass those around. What I've just passed out is retirement drop benefits for Chuck Long, who entered the drop on September 1st after a little over 17 years of service, and he elects to take a 25% lump sum, and the amounts are shown there circled on the form. A lump sum amount, $105,851.06, and he also elected to take a 10-year guarantee with a retiree's lifetime, 120 payments guaranteed, with a monthly payment of $27,51.33.
Move that we approve retirement benefits for Chuck Long.
These are drop benefits.
This one's drop.
I think I'm just going to go home. I move that we approve the drop benefits for Chuck Long.
Second. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
We have any public input or comment? We have no public. Going once, twice. All right. We have a report from our fine friends at Sawgrass.
Good afternoon. I introduced myself, but I'll reintroduce myself. Marty LaPrade with Sawgrass Asset Management. It's been some time since we had a chance to visit, so I'm glad to be here today. We work with you in two arenas. We work with you on the fixed income side. We work with you in the large cap growth side of your portfolio. I'm the portfolio manager on the large cap growth side. So, most of my time will be spent on the stock side. I've got the bond material here as well. We can certainly go down into that. But most of the time spent on the stock side. Just kind of briefly from a business perspective, since we haven't met in some time. From a business perspective, I would say at Sawgrass, pretty much steady as she goes. In terms of our assets under management, we're a little bit under $4 billion, which is our high water mark in terms of assets under management. New business has been generally good for us. We've had Larry and I were talking on the way in, kind of steady growth over the last several years, so that's been a good thing. Employee-wise, I think the last person we added was late last year. We added a compliance someone dedicated solely to compliance. In our world, in the last 4 or 5 years, compliance has become a big part of our business, unfortunately, and so we added somebody solely dedicated to that. But other than that, no real significant changes in terms of staff in the last couple of years other than adding that one person. So steady is good, I think, in our business, and that pretty much describes what's been happening at Sawgrass. Whoever said maybe we live in interesting times, I think we're speaking to where we are right now and what's happened in the last week. What we're going to look at here is actually as of 9:30, so we'll do a little review of where we've been 9:30 and then talk about where we might be, how the portfolio is positioned, and what our thoughts are in that regard. I'm going to go ahead and jump ahead. I've got some kind of reference material, but let me go ahead and just kind of jump to the nitty-gritty on page 11 and page 12. This is the equity portion of the portfolio that we're working with you on. On page 11 there, this is a 936 shot. And we do a little reconciliation. This is just for the quarter in terms of where we started the quarter, a little bit south of $10.6 million. Small investment gain, ending market value of $10.6 million. On the right-hand side of the page there, you see roughly 96% at the end of quarter invested 4% in money market, if you will. When we look down there at the bottom of the page and we look at results, I was also commenting on Larry. I said, I'd rather come after we've had a challenging quarter than when we had a great quarter, because the great quarters are easy. The challenging quarters are the times we need to be here and talk about what's going on in the portfolio. And certainly the last quarter was that for us. If you've taken the snapshot at the end of June, in terms of our rolling results, totally different picture. We had a real strong period in the first 6 months of this year, and our rolling numbers were really strong. As we came into this quarter resulted in one of the more challenging quarters we've had. And we've got to go back about 6 years where we've had this much of a deficit to the benchmark. So this was a really challenging quarter for us. And as we look at it, it was unusual, I think, because it kind of started with the whole Brexit event that happened in late June, where the British voted to leave the European Union. And that kind of triggered a sell-off in the stock market, which was very dramatic. The interesting part was we had a turnaround and a significant rebound right after that through the middle to late part of July. And the interesting aspect of that is the things that were leading that market rally were much different than what we owned in our portfolio. It was sort of like what we saw last year, where you saw things like Facebook and Amazon and the biotech stocks, what I would call the more risky side of the stock market, which really led the stock market up in that quarter. It is hard to wrap your head around why. I think the only real, from a fundamental standpoint, reason that you can get for that is one of the things that did happen with Brexit was there had been an expectation that interest rates might rise as we came into this year. And as the year has gone along, the Fed has said, no, not this quarter. And when Brexit happened, most of the central banks, including our own, said, we're concerned about how this is going to impact the world economy. We're probably not going to raise rates until the end of the year or later. So we have this environment where one of the things that I think stock investors are always paying attention to is my choices are stocks or bonds. And bonds are returning near zero interest rates, stocks look pretty good. And so when we got this idea that, hey, we're not going to raise interest rates for a period of time, maybe investors said, all right, I'm going to return to the stock market and have an environment where we see people seeking a little bit more risk. And that's certainly what we saw in this quarter, which is you really got to go back to 2009 and 10 to see, in our view, a period where we had that kind of environment where it was so risk-oriented. When you look at the longer results here, on a 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, we're behind in those, although on the 5 year, I would say we're in sight of it. We're in the game there, where on a 5 year basis, the Russell 1000 growth is up 16.6%. We're right there at 16%. I would say to you, if you had told me 5 years ago that the market might be up 16% a year for 5 years, I would say that might be a tough environment for us because we tend to have a little bit more risk-conscious approach to how we build our portfolios. These five-year returns are well above what's normal in the stock market. I mean, normal stock market returns are 8 or 9%, depending on which dynamic you're using or what lens you're using. So we've got returns that are significantly greater than normal here, which has been a great thing for portfolios like yours, but we've been in the game, which I think is good. So we feel good about having participated in that. We never feel good about lagging, and we certainly did in the quarter. And that quarter, this most recent quarter, pulled down our numbers on a 5 year basis. But where we are right now, we feel good about our prospects on a relative basis moving forward. The one thing that I would say is, you know, I never forecast where the stock market's going, but I can pretty much guarantee you that we're not going to have a return for the next 5 years at 16% a year. I mean, we've had a rally in the stock market that started in 2009. We've had very little significant pullback since then. The most significant was in 2011. But it's really been kind of a one-way market, and it feels like investors have kind of been reaching for risk. So we think we're about to change in terms of the tone of the market, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. One of the observations that we'd make, if you turn with me to page 13, when you look at our results, and these are five-year results, looking at our portfolio through various measures of risk-adjusted returns, when you adjust our returns for how much risk we're taking vis-a-vis the beta in the portfolio, which is a measure of riskiness, And you measure our returns vis-à-vis the Sharpe ratio, which is a measure of how volatile they are. Our risk-adjusted returns are very, very strong relative to other growth managers. And you can see over there, we rank well in terms of risk-adjusted returns in those first two panels. And the next two panels kind of just show some of the risk characteristics, standard deviation, or how volatile our returns are near the bottom of the pack, which we think is a good thing. One of the reasons we've been able to do this is our down market capture is amongst the best among this group over a five-year period. In other words, we catch less of the down market than most growth managers. We haven't really had a whole lot of down market other than that 2011 period and a few other periods. But that's one of the things that really keeps us in the game is we tend to protect when we do have down periods. So, you know, our view is we want to grab all the returns we can, but we want to pay attention to how much risk we're taking. And if you look at it on that lens, you know, we've certainly been more than in the game relative to other growth managers. In terms of the characteristics of the portfolio on page 14, just to kind of review our view of the world, and you see earnings growth relative to the Russell 1000, which is actually a little bit less than the market, but what we find is our companies tend to have much more achievable growth rates than the market. We find that often many companies in the index disappoint, and our companies tend to exceed the expectations. And then in terms of what we're paying for those earnings, whether it's PE, price to cash flow, price to sales, price to book, we're paying less than the market overall, which has been a consistent characteristic of the portfolio. In terms of the size of the portfolio, it's actually a little bit bigger than the index, but really pretty similar in terms of average size. And then you see there the top 10 holdings in the portfolio, all pretty recognizable names. I think you recognize pretty much all those on there. And our view is these are companies that have the opportunity to grow their earnings and achieve that growth more so than owning an Amazon or a Facebook, things that have very, very high expectations. And so I'm going to call it companies that have very stable earnings growth that tend to achieve those expectations. In terms of sector differences, on page 15, when we look at our portfolio relative to the index, we don't take big bets in terms of sector differences, so you can see there, I think the biggest difference there is an underweighted technology of about 3% and an overweight in utilities of about 3%. So we're not making big bets about which sector is going to be in favor or out of favor. Rather, we're trying to buy the best companies within those sectors. That's our recipe for adding value over the long run. So you're not going to see big differences there. On page 16, I included in this book this time just the fact that in this quarter where we were very challenged, we made a number of changes to the portfolio this quarter. And they actually added some significant performance. If we had not made any changes to the portfolio, we actually would have been about 60 basis points worse than what we were. So as we came into the quarter, we had some areas of the portfolio that had done well, notably Staples and some of the telecom stocks. And we actually took profits in those companies, which was a good thing because those companies were relatively weak in the quarter, and that helped us. And then we added to the technology area, which was one of the stronger parts of the market in the quarter. So the message here is, you know, it wasn't an environment where we weren't trying to adapt as the market was moving. We were making changes, and they actually helped us. Most quarters where we add this kind of performance in a quarter, we're usually in the game, but it wasn't enough to help us in this particular quarter. When you drill down to some of the individuals, things that helped us and hurt us in the quarter on page 17, we've got a top 10 and a bottom 10 here. And I kind of highlighted at the bottom some of the individual stocks that hurt us in the quarter, and it's a mixed bag of reasons. Each of these stocks, for one reason or another, had an individual challenge that hurt us in terms of performance. On the top half of the page there, you see a number of stocks with very strong performance in the quarter, particularly in the technology area. You know, very, very strong double-digit returns. So we had a number of stocks that did well. We just didn't have enough, and then we had this handful of stocks that were tough for the quarter. The question is, where are we going from here? You know, we've been in this environment where we've had a long bull run. On page 18 here, we're just simply looking at a chart of the S&P 500 that dates back to the peak just before the last financial crisis that we had in 2008 and 2009, and then shows you the subsequent bull market that we've had since then. And at the top, we've got a title that says A Change in the Rate of Ascent. And even for the last couple years, we've really seen a market that's kind of gone sideways, but that's a very steep rise in the market over a fairly short period of time, and as I've mentioned, in our view, kind of above normal. We also show you down there the frequency of decline on average that happens in the stock market. Once every year, you get a 10% decline. Once every 4 years, you get a 20% decline. And once every 8 years, you get a 30% decline or more. Those aren't absolute by any means, but kind of gives you an idea of the fact that, hey, we do have markets that pull back from time to time. We did this year. This year, in the first quarter of the year, we had a market that pulled back almost 15%, turned around and rallied strongly from there. So it's our view that at the least the slope of this decline may change. You know, it's probably likely to be a little bit flatter. And you know, we could have something where the market actually pulls back. I'm not forecasting that. I'm just saying from a historical perspective, that wouldn't be surprising. Typically, it's those type of environments where we tend to do well because, as I mentioned, we tend to protect in those down periods. In the first quarter of this year, when the markets pulled back, our portfolio protected very, very well. In the Brexit week, when the market pulled back 5 or 6%, we protected well. So that recipe works for us. Whether we're headed towards that or not, I don't know. But I do think, you know, we certainly have a sea change here. Regardless of your political affiliation, I think everyone was surprised at what occurred last week, and the markets have certainly shown that. It was very interesting that on election night, as it looked like Trump was going to be elected, the stock market was down 900 points at one point. And the traditional wisdom was if he was to be elected, the market would be down 5 or 10%. That was kind of what all the experts said. Hey, if he gets elected, down 5 or 10%. And you can postulate why. One of the concerns is, you know, protectionism. It was just the opposite. The market turns around last week and has a pretty strong rally. It was interesting in that there were parts of the market that were really, really strong and really, really weak. People were trying to guess what impact his policy might have, and one of the areas that was a big impact was in healthcare, for example, because he's talked about potentially repealing the current Obamacare. And so some of the stocks that were perceived to be really beneficial rallied sharply, and then others, you know, some might be up 10%, 10 or 20%, and others down 10 or 20%. Massive moves, which we haven't seen. Tech stocks are selling off in here. I'm not sure why. Strong dollar, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around. What's fascinating is there's huge moves in the market without really a lot of information. We really don't know what his policies are. The only kind of definitive thing that he says, he'd like to see interest rates normalize. In other words, move back to higher interest rates, which is a little bit unexpected because I think most people had expected rates to rise a little bit. But slowly, you know, not quickly. And I think there's this expectation that rates may rise more quickly. The banks have been very, very strong because they would benefit from that. So we've seen unbelievable volatility in the market. I mean, underneath the surface, I can't tell you the moves that we've seen. And even today, the market was up in the morning, down now. Hard to predict, but I think the one thing we can count on is probably more volatility in the market because there is so much uncertainty. It's going to take a period of time before we really know what unfolds policy-wise. He's got to put together a cabinet, you know, and he's changing as he goes along. He's sort of backed off some of the hard-line comments that he had made in certain areas. And so we really don't know what we have in store for us. There is the prospect, though, that this change does create more growth, does create more economic growth. And at this point, I think expectations were low, so we have the expectation to exceed those. You have a chance to exceed those low expectations. But it's going to take some time to unfold to really discern where we're headed and how things are going to react to that. And from our view, there's just not enough information to make real definitive massive changes because you just really don't know what's going on. You can guess, but you really don't know. But what we do like, our portfolio acted well last week. In all that turmoil, you know, we had a relatively good period where the market was churning. And it's hard to forecast, you know, how that may move going forward. Overall, though, I like where we are in the spectrum, because when you look at the stock market right now, valuations are on the higher side. They're not super expensive, but they're on the higher side. Growth rates, at least as we sit here today, are fairly low. And interest rates are on the rise, which will challenge stock investors, because that makes valuations more challenging. So, again, we believe that having a portfolio right now where we're paying attention to risk is a good thing. There are some environments where we might want to go out and reach for some risk, but we don't think it's right now, particularly when we know as little as we do. So from where we are in terms of the market cycle, from what we know in front of us, and clearly the environment has changed pretty dramatically, we like our relative chances. So despite the fact we had a challenging quarter last quarter, we feel good about our opportunity moving forward in an environment that's likely to be much lower returns. If you ask me to guess whether I would be in stocks or bonds for the next 5 years and I couldn't change my mind, I'd choose stocks right now, because I do think stocks will out-return bonds for the next 5 years. But I think it's likely to be more of this than just straight up. So it's likely to be a more bumpy ride, and I think that's, again, an environment where we have a chance to add some relative value. So that's a long monologue. Let me hesitate there and field any questions on the stock side that anybody might have.
You made any changes last week?
We did. There was a couple, Larry, where the price had moved so much and we started to do something and boom, it turned right around. And that's the type of thing that we will be looking for, some sort of dramatic reaction to a stock, either on the buy or sell side, where we can't see any reason for it. We might go in and try and pick off some things. I think that's the type of thing. But structurally kind of changing the portfolio, not yet.
What kind of information do you look for that gives you direction when it's not as risky or as volatile? I mean, I know right now you're saying it's a world of uncertainty right now. I mean, what are you looking for to kind of give you that direction as to when you can pull the trigger and go somewhere?
Part of it is what you're paying for stocks overall. You know, we're in an environment where we're paying prices that are above average or below average. And right now, we're in an environment where valuations, whether you're looking at PEs or whatever valuation measure you want to use, are above average. You know, some people might say they're way above average. So, number one, we'd rather see an environment where we're paying less for those companies, historically speaking, than you would. That gives us some confidence. We'd like to have some confidence that there is some real growth out there. Much of the return that we've seen in the last 7 years, arguably, is not from the fact that companies have grown their earnings so much. It's just that people are paying more for those companies. You know, they're paying more for them. So I'd rather see prospects where companies are actually going to grow their earnings in an organic way. That would give us some confidence, too. I mean, if we have an administration, if this, whatever we have in front of us, if it turns out to be an environment where, hey, it looks like we're going to be able to spur some growth through infrastructure spending or lower taxes or whatever, you know, the things that he's talked about are, you know, that would give us an environment where, hey, we want to step out and take a little bit more risk. It's not clear right now. And while it is, I think generally it has been positive, the reaction has been much more positive than people expected. Like I said, everybody expected down 5 or 10%, boom. It's just right now, it's hard to discern. The protectionist aspect of his policies are very concerning from an investor perspective. The idea that, hey, we're gonna tax everybody, we're not going to have free trade. He may soften that stance, but those things are very concerning to investors. And there have been situations of protection in the past that triggered big sell-offs in the market. And I think that's one thing that investors are kind of waiting to see how that unfolds, you know, what his policies are towards other countries. That's a concern from an investment perspective, because when you look at our companies, U.S. companies, a large percentage of their revenues come from overseas. And so if we alienate or tariff or or hinder free trade, that jeopardizes U.S. companies, particularly large U.S. companies and their ability to exist. So that's something we want to pay attention to. So better valuations, better growth, some clarity, I think, on where we're headed policy-wise would change our appetite for risk.
Most of the companies that they own have a tendency to be able to produce relatively good earnings no matter what the economic climate. So that's one of the reasons why they don't tend to do as well in the strong up markets, because the market tends to reward riskier companies that may be growing their earnings at 40%. Maybe they're a smaller company, maybe they've got something that happened, but they can grow as quickly on a short-term basis. But if the market rolls over or the economy rolls over, they don't deliver. Their companies are typically the ones that kind of give you the steady, not all of them, but most of them give you that steady income stream. And sometimes in these strong bull markets, don't get rewarded. They kept up a little better than I expected them to.
Can you take going into what you're saying about the next 5 years and what you expect? Your performance should improve.
Well, my guess. I mean,
yeah.
No, manager's ever going to say, hey, my performance is going to be crummy. I mean, but I would tell you, you know, if we were sitting here at the bottom of this sell-off, when things do get risky, when the market turns, that's a challenging period for us. But when we've had a long, extended bull market like this and valuations are above average, I like my chances better here than here. And it's down here where we would say, hey, now, you know, somewhere on that ride down, we'd say, hey, we need to take a little bit more risk because at some point this thing might turn around. I'm not forecasting a 50% down move. That was a 50% down move in the market. Those are periods where we say, guys, we're down 20, 30, 40%. I don't know how long it's going to last, but it's going to turn at some point and you want to take a little more risk. But up here, yeah, I think we want to be smart about it. Yeah. Anything else we can share on the stock side? On the bond side, flip. Got here. I'm going to turn and jump ahead. I find that I put too much stuff in. Turn page 30. And let's talk about bonds for a second. On the flip side, on the bond side, we had a good quarter this quarter. Our portfolio was up about 60 basis points. The benchmark was up about 30 basis points. In bond land, those are relatively good returns. That was the case on the 1 year, 3 years. I mean, all of those periods have been favorable. You know, it's been a one-way street in bond land here until just last week, where interest rates have been low, and going lower. You know, and our strategy has been to take a little bit less risk, not quite have so much bet on rates going lower, you know, more of an anticipation of rates going higher in the portfolio. And then in terms of what parts of the market we own less of the individual treasuries, because those are the most expensive part of the market, and more in high quality corporates, and that's been a good strategy for us. I will tell you that the bond market got pumped last week. Some of the biggest down days the bond market overall has had, because rates were up. I mean, we had big moves in interest rates because of this anticipation, based on comments that were made, that we're going to let interest rates normalize. Who knows what that means, but hey, people think the party's over and rates are off to the races. So that has been a definitive change. And I think, you know, our bond portfolio is structured relatively well, depending on the moves inside for that. And our bond portfolio is one where, again, we're trying to discern how much risk we want to take in terms of the interest rate bet that we're making, whether we're longer or shorter than the benchmark. And then in terms of the quality of companies we own, it tends to be a higher quality portfolio as well, because in this environment, particularly as rates rise, we think that would be a good place to be. So the short story on the bond side is, you know, the bond portfolio has had a good period of time. Absolute returns are going to be tough, at least as we sit here in this particular quarter, for bonds, because rates to this point have risen. Whether we end out the quarter and the year or not, we'll see. But it looks like relative, absolute returns are going to be tough, but on a relative basis, you know, I feel like you should be in the game there. I'd be glad to drill down as deep as you like on any of this, but I know.
Question on the bond was changing the benchmark to allow them to go a little bit more defensive, and you had asked me last quarter about the impact, and the answer I would tell you, and Marty, not a bond guy, but he might be able to back me up on it, but the answer to that's yes. It has, when I show you your rankings are going to be a little bit below average, but yet you're beating your benchmark. So what's that tell you? That tells you your benchmark is just a little bit shorter, a little bit more defensive than the, say, the Barclays aggregate by itself. So we did make that decision in anticipation that we would see a rising rate environment. We never saw it until just last week. But, so relative to other bond managers, you're a little bit below them. Relative to that benchmark, you're above it. I like that positioning because we get into that rising rate environment that we thought we were going to see earlier. And if we get into any kind of a growth, higher growth environment, and like you said, Trump's indicated we have higher inflation, and Trump has indicated letting rates normalize a little bit higher, I think the odds of us going into a higher rate environment have increased substantially. Dramatically higher? No, but will we be glad we kind of are a little bit defensive on our bond portfolio?
Yeah,
I think so.
I would agree with that.
I think letting them, and they can go even shorter than they are now if they choose to do so.
Well, that was the question I asked last time was, you know, give what we allowed them, all the changes we made to allow them some flexibility wasn't working.
Well, as Larry said, until this quarter, most recent quarter that we're not looking at, probably was neutral to, you know, neutral at best. But I think in the environment that we may be in now, where it looks like we probably will have some rise in interest rates, how fast and how far, the answer is yes.
And there just hasn't been much money to be made in bonds, no matter where you were. Unfortunately, you don't have a lot of them. That's 27% of your portfolio, or something that might have more. It's helped you.
I just know when I think back, and this is like 5-6 years ago, those numbers were radically different.
From
as good as they're doing relative to the benchmarks and stuff, they're
right.
And that was the whole reason that, I think it was 2 years ago, I'm sorry, Dale. 2 years ago when we had that big, long, hour and a half long discussion, decided to change everything, and that's what, you know, I'm all for an experiment, but I just want to see, does everybody think the experiment's working?
It hasn't had a chance to work as well as I think it will work, but your portfolio's doing okay, yes. Kind of hitting home runs in the bond market, but honestly, that's not what we want to do.
No, I get it.
That's kind of the protection part of your portfolio for when the world goes nuts.
Right.
When?
Yeah.
Oh, you meant the stocks.
Yeah, the world.
We appreciate the business very much. We've had a long relationship with you. I think Dale and I have met each other for 20-plus years.
Right.
We've worked for the city in various capacities, and we really value the relationship. So, thank you. And you know, anytime, you know, we haven't seen you in quite a while. Larry, like I said, I'd rather be here when there's more explaining to do than not. So, but anytime you need to see us, we're not far away, and certainly can come and visit with you. Any questions?
Thank you. All right, Larry, you're up.
All right, folks. Well, good news is I can't talk long because I can't talk. So, like you done. So, Mindy, welcome. Is this your first official?
Official, yes, sir.
Official.
Thank
welcome
you.
Aboard. Steve, thanks for coming back. That's the bet on that one, dude. All right, so take a look. We'll start off on pages 5, 6, and 7, and those are your kind of the investment policy reviews and summary. They
I'll talk about each of the managers in just a minute, but the main section there, I think that's obviously very important at fiscal year end, especially is on page seven. That page is all related to compliance. If anything is marked no in that category, we need to get it fixed. We look at it every quarter, but if anything is marked no there, you need to fix this because it's out of compliance with the investment policy and potentially state statute. So that's what we review that for you every quarter. You can see that the answers are all yes there, so we had no compliance issues. And again, I'll talk about the individual managers. You will see on the previous two pages some of the boxes marked no, because they're all related to performance goals for managers. And I'm going to talk about those when we talk about the managers. So from our salary compliance related statement, come down here on those. Page eight are your returns net of investment management fees. And you can see for the quarter, this is again net of all your investment management fees. I'll show you gross returns in a second. Not that the returns are gross, but gross of fees. The quarter was 2.8%. The benchmark was 3.5. 1 year is 9.1 versus 9.8. So did have a very good fiscal year, by the way. You're up over 9%.
That's a fiscal year return?
Yes, that is your fiscal year, that 1 year return. So that was your fiscal year return net of investment management fees, a little over 9%. Your benchmark, or your assumed rate is 8. I think it's still 8, right?
Yeah,
8. So we were able to get it a little bit above that. The 3-year return at 6 is right on top of the benchmark. And then your 5-year return net of investment management fees is 10% per year. Benchmark is 10.2. Again, I kind of go back to something Marty said. If you'd have told me 5 years ago we were going to have 10% returns and we were keeping up with it, I'd tell you, we probably won't. We kept up with it a lot better than I thought we would. Normally where this plan has historically added a lot of value relative to the benchmark and even relative to peer groups is when the market goes the other way. It's got conservative managers. When I've brought managers to the board in the past, what the profile of a management firm that I typically will bring to you is one that might be, let's say they capture maybe 90% of the upside of the market. When the market's going up, maybe they only get about 90%, but they only get about 80 or 85% on the downside of the market. When you kind of compound that out in a tax-exempt portfolio over time, you'll like that combination. You end up with better returns than your benchmarks and less risk. So if we get that combination, we'll go for it. Well, we've had nothing but bull market, basically, for the last 5 years, and you've still been able to capture almost 100% of it. So that's kind of a pleasant surprise. I hope I don't get pleasantly surprised on the other side. When it goes down, we don't protect as well as I expect. But you saw Marty's portfolio, and it's one that is, at least historically, has done very well when the market rolls over. Page 9, and by the way, when I'm looking at my book, I may be looking up here. I've got one page different than you, so I get confused if I'm looking down and you're looking up. Now, page 9 is the asset allocation. As of September 30, you can see we're a little overweighted in domestic equity relative to the benchmark. The gold mine is the target policy in the investment policy statement. We're still a little underweighted in MLPs. I'll talk about them in a minute. Those are your master limited partnerships that primarily investments in pipelines and storage facilities for oil and natural gas in the U.S. Convertibles, slight underweight. Pretty good underweighting still in international, and I'm going to keep it there. Recommend you keep it there. I still think the domestic markets are more attractive, although that could change. Real estate, private real estate, we're right on the benchmark, and then you can see we're pretty close to the benchmark in our bond portfolio. So no rebalancing recommendations. This would be, if I thought you should move some money around, this would be where I would recommend that, but I'm not recommending anything. Page 10 are your managers and how they're all allocated. You see it's a very well-diversified portfolio. The large cap managers, small, mid cap managers, investing small and mid sized companies. You have convertible managers, international, and the real estate and the MLPs. So, one of the things we've had to do over the last several years is to keep the risk, keep an acceptable level of risk in the portfolio or volatility, but also still try to make that 8% return, is to diversify the portfolio into some additional asset classes. They don't all move the same direction at the same time, so it helps kind of smooth the ride. You can kind of see a little bit of that on page 11. I don't always cover these charts, this chart, but especially for the new trustees,
page, on the right-hand side, that's your asset allocation 5 years ago, and then on the left-hand side is the current asset allocation. So you'll notice a few more colors and more change there, and that's the additional diversification. Page 12 and 13, I can cover pretty much all the managers and everything right here. The fund for the, these are gross of investment management fees. You can see the total fund return was 2.9%. At parentheses number 76, that means we were in the bottom seven to the bottom 24%. So it wasn't a good quarter, relatively speaking. The benchmark was up 3.5%. For the 1 year, we were just about in the middle of the pack. So we did have a good year on a 9.7% return, but in the 50th and first percentile, so 50 being right in the middle of the pack. And the pack here, by the way, is this is a public pension fund universe across the country, not even just Florida. These are multi-billion dollar plans down to $1 million plans. So I believe the number, don't hold me to it, but I'm going to say it's about, I think this, about 600 plans, I think, in this universe. Don't hold me to it, I'll confirm that, but I think it's around 600. So all sizes and a pretty broad spectrum. And some states have different rules too, so you know it's not always apples to apples. But anyway, it's a pretty good comparison, let you know how you're doing, get your peer group. The 3 year number of 6.6 ranks in the top 31%, so top third. The 5 year number of 10.6% is above the benchmark of 10.2 and ranks in the top 15%. So on a 5 year basis, the plan has ranked in the top 15% of public pension funds. We like that number. When we get down to the individual managers, there's always somebody that is struggling a little bit. In this case, we had two managers that struggled a little bit, and they're large cap managers. That's Westwood with a 1.4% return versus a benchmark of 3.5, and then you heard from Marty on the 0.3 for Sawgrass versus 4.6. Both of those numbers rank poorly relative to the peer group and were underperforming the benchmark. Both for the same reasons, really, and that is the type of stocks, the quality, the risk off trades that they have. In other words, they don't take a lot of risk. Risk is rewarded in this period. Both of those large cap managers have very good defensive makeup in their portfolios and tend to really catch up when the market goes the other way. So when you go across the 5 years, that does take into account a little bit of some bear markets, but anyway, they're both surprisingly keeping up to me. Again, pleasant surprise. Westwood is 16% per year. Sawgrass is also 16% per year for the last 5 years. Both of them a little bit below their benchmark and just a little bit below their peer group, but again, it's been nothing but bull market for the most part. So give this thing a full cycle, see what happens when the market goes the other way, and I'll show you some statistics to back that up in just a second and why I'm patient with them and have a lot of confidence that they're still should still be your managers. Frontier and Hood River are both relatively new, small to mid-cap managers, so they're buying smaller companies, and it's the pond they fish in, and you can see those numbers are very, very good. Frontier had an 8.9% quarter that ranked in the top 26%. They had a 21% year. Across the board, Frontier, I've been with you a little bit longer, they've had 21% per year return for the last 5 years. That's the top 3%. Of people who do what they do. So this is a peer group comparison for, that when I get down to the manager level, those numbers in parentheses are comparing them to other people who do what they do. Fish in the same pond, kind of do the same style of management. So in this case, small cap value managers, they're clobbering everybody. Hood River really struggled this quarter. As you can see, they were only up 15%. That's not an annualized number. That's one quarter of 15.4%, top 2% of their peer group, beat the benchmark by a lot. And then their 1 year number is still 17.5% and top 18%. So they're off to a great start with you. We don't always have that kind of luck when we hire a manager right off the bat, but that's a great start. MLPs are an investment we've spent a lot of time talking about. We're underweighted relative to the benchmark, but this is an investment primarily in pipelines and storage facilities for oil and natural gas being pumped out of the U.S., pumped from the U.S. So if it's coming out of the ground in North Dakota, Texas, wherever, if it's coming out of the ground, it's got to go from point A to point B, and you own those toll roads. You own the pipelines and you own the storage. They got hammered right after we got in them. The correlation to the price of oil went up from a long-term average of about 40%. That's the movement that it has relative to the price of oil. When we went into the asset class and recommended the asset class to the board, that long-term correlation was only at about 40%. So it looked like a good diversification tool, not only for not buying oil, you're not buying natural gas, you're buying the toll road. Those correlations went above 80% when oil went in the tank. About 60% of what's going through those pipelines is natural gas, so we couldn't figure out why was there such a correlation to the price of oil, but that's what happened. The volumes going through the pipeline were only down about 3 to 4% year over year, but it went down about 40%. The price went down about 40%. So fundamentally, it doesn't make any sense. Still doesn't make any sense. And so I hung in there, and as you can see, they have come back. With oil stabilizing a little bit, we were up 11.4%. There's a lot of MLPs in this space, and they're in the index that you would not want to own. And again, that's one of the reasons why you see a little bit of underperformance relative to the benchmark. High-quality companies, Westwood buys high-quality companies with good, safe bet that they're going to pay those dividends and pay those distributions to you. The index has a lot of companies in there that might not be able to do that. So we don't own those, but they got rewarded. If you did own those, you got a nice reward last quarter. But it's high risk, high reward. These pay a dividend of about 5 to 7%. So it's a good yielding product. They don't move in the same direction as stocks and bonds. They're kind of their own thing, so it's a good diversification tool. Convertibles are the same way. Convertibles we've had for quite a while. The convertibles are a hybrid instrument. They're a bond instrument that has the ability to convert into stocks. We used convertibles a few years ago to allow us to lower bond exposure without taking the risks of stocks, the full risk of the stock market. Convertibles have a history, at least the pattern would be that they'll capture about 70 or 75% of the upside of the stock market, but only about 50 to 55% of the downside. So a less volatile instrument, higher yielding than bonds. For every dollar we put into convertibles, which was about $5 million, I guess it wasn't that much at the time, but every dollar that went into convertibles earned 9.7%. That money, if you assume it would have been in bonds, they only earned 2.8%. So every dollar that went in there is not good. Advent is also a very high quality manager, so the underperformance relative to the benchmark is not a concern to me right now. Their peer group in the 5 years, they're still well above average in the 44th percentile. They do buy in the area we like. The convertible market, I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but you can buy some real junk bonds in there, and you can buy some convertibles that are so far in the money they just behave like a stock. They buy in the middle range, and that's where we want to buy. Euro-Pacific is the international exposure, had a really good quarter, up 8.2%. You see it's been a good investment for you longer term relative. 9.1% per year in the top 22%. And you have real estate on the bottom of page 12 and the top of page 13. That's also really good. That's been 11.4% per year for the last 3 years. So that was a good diversifier. And then you have the bond portfolio that you just heard on page 13 from mine. Just hasn't been a lot to get out of bonds. Might be interested in page 15. Page 15, the green line is your cash flow, that's contributions minus withdrawals. The blue line is your market value every quarter, that's going back for 5 years. So the difference between that green line and the blue line is the earnings that you've had on the fund for the last 5 years. And that number actually is $24,590,000 for the last 5 years. So markets have been very good to the plan.
Yeah, if you could get some
deep
water, the green line
would
come back up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to keep the blue line going up when the green line doesn't go up.
Well, it's a little easier to go the other way. Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
All right, because you know how I am. I'll roll a little bit. I understand our purpose. I understand it's long-term and everything. Why would we not take a little bit?
Uh-huh.
And go to the what we're missing on the large cap side, but like, and I'm throwing a generalized example, like an index fund. type thing.
Upside caps.
And get what we're missing. And it's no offense to either manager.
No.
But we're missing a lot right here. I understand,
yep.
You know, it saves us a lot and it may even out in the long run. I don't know. I guess that would be kind of my question. Would it even out in the long run to do that?
More than, I think just a little more than even out the approach you have now. We've had a lot of those discussions internally, and I'm not saying that in the future we might not do that, because it is obvious, especially with the two managers you happen to have in the large cap space, they're not capturing much of the upside. I've got some other data that shows that. So we're really suffering on this upside swing, more so even than usual, I would say. If you look at some of their long-term numbers, I'd say they capture more upside over the longer term than they have recently. So the question is, yeah, I like that downside protection, but how patient do you stay on that upside? But again, look at their numbers. Even over just a short 5-year period, they're only a couple basis points behind that benchmark. And all you're going to get out of an index fund is that benchmark. You're guaranteed to underperform the benchmark with an index fund by the amount of the fee, basically. So when I look at 16 versus 16.2 per year for the last 5 years in that market, I'm very pleased. So, and actually, that's a good segue. Because look at, I don't know if this really answers your question, but look at page 19. Go down to the bottom right on page 19, Mike. You see that down market capture and up market capture? Well, they're capturing 90 of the last three. This is Westwood. They're capturing 95% of the upside over the last 5 years and 90% over the last 3 years. So when the market's going up, they're not doing too bad. And they're only capturing 82% of the downside over the last 3 years and 88%. There haven't been very many downsides.
Mm-hmm.
But they're doing what that profile looks like, what you hire. So the question, I don't know if that didn't really answer your question, because the question is, do we want to get somebody that's got 112% upside to kind of offset these guys? And I might go there down the road. I really might. I might come back to you, but I don't want to go there now, because I think we just got, you know, we're at the end of a 5 or 6 year bull market. I don't know if we're at the end, but we've had a long one. And I don't really feel like trying to get somebody that's got all that.
That's what I just wondered. I mean, it may not be the time, but
down the
just
road,
thinking in my mind, if we get into this type of thing, it may be something to consider.
Yeah, we have an internal investment committee that meets every month at least, and we've had that's been big discussions over the last few months, is do we need to put more fuel into the large cap managers where we can, you know, complement some of these kind of managers with somebody that's got a little bit more risk. And I think maybe longer term, yes. Right now, I don't like it. Not right now. But, and your plan's getting big enough too, you know, the last few years, large enough that we can do that. We can split it up a little bit more. So, but if you look on the next page, page 20, it's even more dramatic with Sawgrass. I think you have a copy of it, Marty. You got down market capture of only 74%. I love that, but his up market capture the last 5 years only 88%. I'd like to see that number more up in the 90s, low 90s. And then the 3 year up market was only 84%.
And yes, so that does answer my question, because I was thinking, you know,
yeah.
90s yeah. plus.
Well, Westwood actually has it,
yeah.
But they've got a little bit higher downside capture, where Sawgrass, lower downside but lower upside. So. Again, if we get into any kind of a true correction, I would expect both of these managers to just crush it from a relative standpoint. Market's down 10, they may lose 5, 6, but they're not gonna lose 10. So I think that would be when you'd say, oh, I see why we have them.
Yeah, I completely understand that. It's just, and that's kind of what I was thinking. Since I came on the board, we basically doubled.
Oh, that's no good.
And that's why I was wondering, you know, at what point do we think it's safe to take a little bit of a chance?
Yeah. I think we could look at diversifying a little bit more down the road. Also, if you look at that on page 20, that Sawgrass, look where their blue dot is right here versus the benchmark. So you heard Marty mention risk-adjusted returns, and that's, we look at that a lot. So they've been able to almost keep up with that benchmark. They're at, I think it was 16 versus 16.2, or 16 versus 16.6, and with significantly less risk over to the left. So we like to hunt. I feel like that's a we start calling in, that's the presenter. Some of the managers you haven't had as long, so one last page you might want to look at is page 17. That's your risk, or your fiscal year returns for the last 11 years. I think that'll show 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 out of those 12. 12, yeah, 8 out of 12 years you've given the assumption rate, at least on a gross return. I would encourage you, if you have any questions, please feel free to call me. You can call, just don't have another trustee in the room, you know that rule. It's not saying a little bit, you certainly are free to call if you need to get up to speed on any of the investments and stuff. Please feel free to give me a call. Glad to help out. But overall, I'm pretty well. I mean, they're a pretty good fiscal year, and we've got some pretty conservative managers who come in there better than I expected. So, I like all of them. I'm looking like I'm going to change things. Hey Doug, how are you doing?
Hey Dale, how's it going?
Good. Guys, we got Doug Lozen couldn't be here, so he's joining us by phone now.
Yeah, so
he's actually supposed to be in combat. There's two versions of that.
Hey Doug, how you doing?
Hey, how are you guys?
Not bad.
Thank you, Marty. Have a good one. What we're discussing is the experience study. That's been brought up at the last couple of meetings. I know when you were here back in May, Doug, we talked about it, and you and I had a conversation about it last week, so we just thought we'd bring it to the board, and we have another issue since Lee's here also that we need to talk a little bit about.
Yep.
Our last experience study was in 2011. You mentioned when you did our valuation report that it may be time to do another one. And we've got a couple of new board members that are here today that have not, in fact, we've got three board members who were not here at that time, but two of them are new on the board. So if you could just kind of tell us what the benefit of an experience study would be, and then what's involved and what the costs are and so on.
All right. Well, an experience study is recommended about every 5 years or so. The last valuation we performed went on was October 1st, 2010. And the rationale for an experience study is the importance of making sure that contributions flow into the trust fund in a manner so that when benefits come due from members retiring, the money's there. Whenever we do evaluation, which is each October 1st, we project out into the future until the last check is cashed using about seven assumptions. The more important ones being life expectancy, salary increases, and investment return. And so we want to make sure that we're keeping tabs that experience is matching those assumptions. So about every 5 years, we recommend going through this exercise to do any true-ups so that we don't have any unexpected results going forward. The cost for us to do this, we'd have to go back, you know, we have to go back in time and look at a lot of different data for all seven assumptions. And now we have two tiers of members. We have the grandfathered group and the unprotected group for benefit. So our fee for going through this study with a report and a present allocation would be $10,000.
What did we pay last time?
I'm sorry, there's somebody face that I didn't hear much.
What was it the last time, Doug?
Give me a moment, I can probably dig that out for you. Let me look this up on the computer.
The other ones I've ordered there as well.
Study, okay, that was done in summer. Last time it was $4,000. That was back in 2011.
So basically what it boils down to is because we now have two sets of numbers that you have to do, it's going to more than double.
Yeah, and we're getting better technology for running these experience studies. We've upgraded to a basically state-of-the-art subscription service for valuation, so we're able to really dig in and really make it a more in-depth report than we've been able to do in the past.
What do you mean by more in-depth?
Well, we can more finely study when members retire and terminate based on precise age and service. Previously, it was more like big buckets. We would look at people by like 5-year buckets of age and service. Now we can finally study the actual experience per person over a longer period of time, more finely during the study.
And the potential benefit in that is that it could lower the cost by having a more precise number.
Well, the funding could go up, but the better precision allows us to keep the plan on track so that whether the cost would be going up or down, it more matches reality. Mm-hmm. For example, we all know that we have to adopt a Florida retirement system for mortality with the next report. But I want to really get in and study, you know, what's the behavior pattern been for the police officers when they take early and normal retirement. You know, there's some years when they're taking it less often than we had assumed, and other years when they're taking it more often. Turnover by age and service. You know, how are the officers behaving based on age and service for termination of employment? Those are very important assumptions that if we're off on, I unfortunately would be coming back in the future and saying, well, your costs are going either up or down unexpectedly. And that's the last thing we want is having unexpected results, because then everybody scratches their head and they don't know what to trust.
Well, I know the last time we had a big long conversation because it was stagnant as far as salary increases and everything, and we had a discussion that accurate numbers might be like us just starting into a contract right now, where I can tell you down to the penny what every employee at the Ocala Police Department, police officer wise, is going to make this year, next year, and the following year as far as salaries. And all would that help benefit?
Absolutely.
That's actually what I called you about.
Yeah, that would be very good information that we can incorporate in the study.
Because I think last time you were using like a number of 6%, and we took it down to like 2 or something, wasn't it?
It varied. It started at 6% if you had less than 10 years and scaled down to 4% once you had higher service.
Did you say general?
Yeah, they ordered their experience studies, so no, they're underway.
I'm not sure if anybody's saying anything. I'm not picking up. But are there any questions? on this and the scope and the pricing?
The pricing, frankly, is a little concerning.
Okay, I understand that. So if you're thinking because of the big jump from the last time the bill back in 2011?
What do we get beat up on about every year? Every year that this goes to anything, every year in the legislature, what do we get beat up on?
The unfunded mandate, the increasing costs, and so on and so on.
Bingo.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's a... frankly, it's a huge increase for over 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, not that it's a
I can bump it down a little bit. Like you recognize, you know, we've got two different groups of people now. We're studying the grandfathered and the non-grandfathered, and we've had a technology upgrade, but, you know, we are sensitive to the costs for these governmental plans. $7,000, that pique your interest a little bit better.
I'm sorry, you broke up a little bit. Did you say seven?
Seven, yeah.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, no, we understand the sensitivity. That's why we're always, you know, our firm always goes to bat publicly for these governmental plans. So the last thing we want to do is do something that causes eyebrows to raise, you know, for fees. We do have to cut. It is very labor-intensive. You've got... you know, a whole group of highly credentialed, educated folks working on this. It's not, we're not just pulling a lever. You know, the computer cranks out the data, but it takes people to study it and to, you know, talk about it and think about which direction to go. So, you know, you're talking mostly labor involved, but, you know, we are sensitive to cost, so.
What kind of time frame on this, Doug? Is this in conjunction with the evaluation study, or is...
Well, we couldn't do it at the same time because it does take quite a while to do these studies. I would first want to present the 16 valuation, get that approved, and then come to the following meeting with the actual experience study. It takes quite a while to go through the study and make the presentation and do the Q&A.
Okay.
And I've learned that if you try to put that report in with the evaluation report, it's just, it's too taxing on everybody mentally. It's just too much to go over in one meeting.
Okay.
Assuming we have an established relationship with this company, are there other companies that do this?
This Doug is with Foster & Foster. He's been our actuary for a number of years now. And there probably are. The question, Doug, is there are other companies that do this in addition to you guys? And there are a lot of other companies out there. When we hired Foster & Foster many years ago, we went out with an RFP, and the board decided at that time to hire them. And they've done a fantastic job for us every year. They do our evaluations. And quite honestly, they do a lot of work for us that I would venture to say is not compensated from time to time. When we have questions about things, we call them, and they're always more than willing to answer the question, and they're providing us templates for doing our calculations of retiree benefits. So we don't, unlike the general plan, they do theirs, but then they send them to the actuary, and the actuary actually does them, and it costs a lot more money. We actually do our own using their templates. So.
Is this a fair comparison? I think you said fire department was known in the general employees.
Well, the general plan, I mean, we dwarf your plan in size, so it's kind of that's way important. I mean, we're like $126 million in our plan compared to your plan, so you can't match. And fire's smaller than you guys, so theirs is less. So your price-wise, you're about middle of the road, and the general plan uses Foster & Foster as well.
Okay. All right, the general plan uses everybody different. We keep switching.
We just use everybody here.
And yeah, I think there was a NIHRT right now, IRS. And you know, I don't know if you had the pleasure of reading an actuarial report in the past. The way Foster Foster presents it, it's actually more easily understandable, you know, the explanation, and because it's a very complicated mathematical information. But they do a really great job in making it very lay terms. I know I call them often. I'm not on the board, but I'll call all the time and say, I wonder about this, wonder about that. And they get to send me a bill for all those phone calls. So they're thinking of them.
So. After discussion, we would need two motions, right? One to do it, and another one for the amount.
That'll be one motion.
You can do it in one motion?
That's correct.
One's got to make a motion. I can't.
I want to see them making a stick on the proper roads. I'm afraid to say anything. I'm afraid he's going to run out.
We would need a motion that we want to do the experience study, have Foster and Foster do it, and for a price of $7,000, right? Right, Doug?
That's right. That's correct.
Okay. I make a motion that we want the experience study done by Foster and Foster for the agreed amount of $7,000.
I'll second.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Nobody. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it very much. And I'll wait until the next comment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Doug. While Doug is on the line, we have an ordinance that was enacted last year as a result of, is actually a reduction in benefits ordinance to members except for those who were within 5 years of normal retirement as of November 1st of 2015. It reduced the benefit rate from 3.33% to 3% going forward. And also made some minor changes in the drop in terms of drop term didn't change, but drop earnings for the member changed. It was reduced as well based on a sliding scale between 1% and 3% depending upon what the plan had earned during the period. And then also we had two $5 supplements that had been added to the benefit over the years, and it eliminated that supplement going forward. And Doug's office has prepared us two benefits templates. It's updated the current template for, which would essentially be for grandfathered members, those going forward who retire in the future, who are grandfathered in, meaning they're within, as of November 15th of last year, they're within 5 years of normal retirement. It made a couple of minor changes in it, and then also a new template for those who are not grandfathered in. That's anybody who's not within 5 years. The problem we're having is an interpretation of the ordinance. Doug's personnel basically looked at it one way and we looked at it a different way, and I sent it to Lee last week, and Bob Doug was on the phone. We wanted to try to get that ironed out. What we're looking for is a template that would, somebody who had say 18 years of credited service, their benefit rate should be 3.33% for the first 18 years, and then the next 7 years would be at 3%, and they would earn the $10 a month supplement for the first 18 years, but then no supplement prospectively or going forward. That's how I understood the ordinance to read, and that's what I've explained to Doug, and so
some members of his staff.
I understood it too.
That's how we understood it in.
And I went back, I got this from Dale last Thursday, and I went back to review the CBA where it emanated from, and that's the way it reads as well.
Hey, guys, is there a way that Lee could maybe be a little closer to the speaker? I can't make him out.
Doug, yeah, I just said everybody here was interpreting after it would be applicable to those after the November 15th date of 2015. And when I received the email chain from Dale last Thursday, I looked at it, and that's, and I also reviewed the last collective bargaining agreement, and that's how it reads as well. So it should be applicable to just the time after the November 15th date, or inapplicable, as Dale said.
So the loss of the $10 supplement would not be for the entire 25 years, it would only be for that time earned from November 1st going forward.
Right.
Got it.
Right.
We consider that investing benefit, you know, discussions at the time, that, you know.
That's how I had understood it.
Yeah.
And I think the way Braylene had drawn that template up, Doug, was basically a calculation up through 10/31/15, and then a different calculation from 11/1 going forward. That's how it appeared to be to me.
Yeah, we did protect the 3.33 through October 1st, 31st, and then 3% forward. But what we did based on the reading of the ordinance, which is no different from what we just discussed today, the language simply said, you know, those members who are not within 5 years of the normal retirement age shall not be entitled to a supplemental benefit. But given all the input from here today, what we'll do is modify the templates to protect the supplemental benefit for service through November 1st, 2015. And I'll also build that back into the valuation when I come with the report later this winter.
Yeah, I know the reading of those two paragraphs of the ordinance state that effective November 15th, members who are not within 5 years of normal retirement are not entitled to the supplemental benefit, but I think all that intended was going forward. They've already earned the others, so they won't lose what they've already earned.
Yeah, everybody has it just respectively, grandfather, so let's keep it, and everybody else did.
Yeah, we'll just build that back in to everything then.
And then I can talk to you about this later, Doug, when we're not in the meeting, but that'll be a template where it'll actually automatically calculate that. I wanted to do two separate calculations. Is that correct?
Yeah, we can talk offline about that.
Okay. All right. I'll give you a call about that. That's just the mechanics of how to actually do the calculation then. So.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you, Doug.
Anybody else have anything for Doug? Okay, Doug, thank you very much, and I'll talk to you in the next day or so.
Okay, guys, take it easy. I look forward to seeing you in a few months.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, then?
Yep.
All right. So, now are we doing the summary plan description?
Yes.
I know we got out of order here.
Well, we had...
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I have one agenda made up, and then we had to Doug in, and I made another one, and apparently I copied the wrong agenda for you guys here.
All right.
Okay, and I'm updating the summary plan description. When I got this issue in the email last week, I put a hold on until we were all on the same page to be sure that we agreed on how the calculation would be done. Now that's been determined, I'll simply reflect that in the SPD, and then it will be all set.
Are we behind in getting that out?
Yeah, 2 years was February.
Yeah, our last one was actually approved by the board on May 12th of 2014.
Right. But we had it on hold intentionally for a while until all the new provisions were take care of.
Okay, so you'll have that for us at the February meeting, which is February 13th?
For sure.
For sure.
For sure.
Okay.
Matt, what else you got?
Well, I'm pleased to know, not too much. Did everybody get the quarterly meetings for next year, the scheduled quarterly?
I've got them right here.
Okay. Dale's got those. The other item, two items I wanted to mention, financial disclosures. Partisan believes 6 weeks, you'll be able to file them again for next year, for this calendar year. So, and you'll be getting multiple reminders from me on that, as you know. But those forms should be out shortly after the first of the year, if not before. The other item is the an item for compliance with Senate Bill 172, which we talked about. We recall our last meeting, or two meetings ago, actually, we adopted a budget for the next fiscal year and filed with the city as required. We also, now that the last fiscal year has ended, which is September 30th, 2016, we should have at our next meeting a schedule of the administrative expenses actually incurred for the fiscal year ending September 30th for board approval and filing also.
Are you going to wait until the city actually closes the books, or are you just going to do an estimated?
Well, this one is for the year that we should have those, if not now, pretty soon, because this is for the fiscal year.
I understand that, but I put the CAFRA out, and we do check runs all the way through November for the prior year, because things that happened in September, those vendors were billing us.
Well, when you have the final thing,
Well, you guys don't meet until February. I was thinking
we'll
next month.
We won't meet next month.
Yeah, I was thinking, because I can't get the
checkbook. No,
yeah. Right. So I don't want to get the checkbook out in February, but we'll be closed. So we can give you closed numbers in February. CAFRA usually comes out in March, so, but we'll have.
Did we get some examples of the other agreements as far as share plan stuff like that? Or we asked for?
Yeah, I sent some.
Okay, we got some of those. All right. Because that still has to be, because at this, you haven't been here in the last couple of meetings, you were under the impression that you know, the union was under the impression that the city was supposed to do it, the city was under the impression that the union was supposed to do it. So I don't care who does it.
And we were,
somebody's just got to do it.
We've also heard that if you have an agreement in place, that the agreement stands first, and so...
No, see, that's the problem. When we went into the new agreement, when we renegotiated the contract, we put that out. We were in an agreement, but once that agreement went bye-bye, because the new one took its place, that's after the date. It needed to be done.
Well, to establish it, yeah.
We have a share plan in the ordinance that just passed.
Right.
So we're in compliance for that purpose. You want to change it, negotiate it, make changes, then that can be done. As far as compliance, that was in the last ordinance.
Yeah.
The other item, the final item, will be the, which I think is what you're referring to, is the mutual consent between the city and the membership on use of the state money.
And that's what we were trying to get everybody to do at one time. And that's why I was trying to get the union people in here, and so everybody would know, and they could hear it all at one time. This is what everybody needs to do, and this is what you guys... And then they could have done it all at the same time when they were doing the reopeners and stuff and renegotiating the contract. We could have gotten it all out of the way at once.
Well,
that's where I was kind of aiming.
Agreed on our state money. That's in the CBA, how the state money is being spent.
Was it referred to as being part of the mutual consent?
Yeah.
I'll take a look. Maybe that may qualify.
Because that law went into effect a couple of years, went into effect before we did the reopener for the Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
So we determined how we were going to split, and both fire and police. I mean, you guys don't have extra money.
Well, it was going to be, the date was going to be October 1, 2015, or when the next agreement was entered into.
And we entered into it over that summer. So we are, the law passed on.
We were in agreement through 9/17. We were supposed to be in until 17. But we renegotiated, and now it's still 18.
But in the CBA, it talks about...
The current contract was asking the current contract in 2018.
Okay. We did a 3-year, but only did 1 year, and then did another 3 years. So we're doing 2 3-year contracts in a 4-year period. Figure it out now.
What? Yeah, it's all very straightforward.
But either way, when the law, that law came out, because I know we were negotiating with, we had all the contracts open that summer, and we were like, you know, because the law passed, but we signed all the contracts like in July, and they said if you had it in there, you were good. And we determined how we would split it in both contracts. And, until, and when we reopened, that was not one of the articles we reopened. We stayed with how it was splitting. Well, and again, police doesn't have excess money, so there isn't splitting. Fire had excess money, so their formula is quite complicated. That's a couple of things. It's agreed to the CBA.
So if that wording's already in the collective bargaining agreement,
then we don't need to do anything.
We're okay.
Hopefully not. I'll take a look at it.
Okay.
There's nothing. From what I can recollect, Rock, and I just read it, there's nothing that says state money or anything that actually made it into the contract, I don't think. I don't know if that was discussed because, again, we don't do it. So,
I'll check it.
All right.
Because it is something that if we haven't done it.
I just don't want to get I don't want to hear that state guy ever tell me again because I said so.
Right. And that's basically what he told us.
For those that weren't here, well, we had an assumption rate, and they went, and we had told Kelly how much money we needed that year, and then we had this teleconference, and he goes, no, you're lowering it to such and such. And it's like, why? Because I said so. Not because the state had determined anything. It was because I said so. And he's the actuary for the state of Florida. And we had to come back and get another $197,000, like, in September into the budget for October 1.
Cindy, would you, since we have multiple agreements we've referred to, could you
send me
the one and I'll be sure we're all on the same page?
In fact, I think we just recently got to execute your customers.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was waiting for that for a whole different set of reasons.
Me too.
That it?
That's it?
Oh, where's the legislature time section? Never mind. All right, Dale, you're the man.
I got two items. We did receive our state money, and it did go up a pretty good bit. $516,594 this year, and it was like $437 last year.
Yeah.
So it went up significantly.
Good.
And we do have several drop payouts coming up. And I'll talk to Larry about this, but... he was under the weather, so he had to leave. But we've got about $600,000 in drop payouts between now and the end of... Actually, one of them will be payable in January. And so we'll have to raise some money for that. We had one last month that was payable this month, but we had sufficient cash on hand for that one. And we may also have an additional lump sum payout when Billy Woods retires at the end of the month. I don't know if he's going to take a lump sum or not, and which he may or may not. I mean, that's, we won't know until the calculation's done.
All right, so do we need to do a contingency motion that wherever Larry decides it wants to come from?
Well, typically these have been coming from large cap or large cap.
I know, but we've done a motion every time. Can we do an open-ended motion like that, Lee?
On this issue, you can.
Okay. Yeah, I think it would be best that we can...
He's probably going to say take it from large cap again.
Yeah, typically we've shared it between the two, but there have been a couple of times we've taken it from one of the other funds. So.
We've got some money in cash a little, don't we? Or
I don't know if that's still there or not.
Oh, okay.
That was going to lead me to, the cash thing was going to lead me to my question for Dale in a minute, but and actually for both of you. So the motion can be fairly generalized?
Yeah.
As to wherever Larry wants to get the money for to pay what we got to pay.
Yeah, we're looking
pretty general.
We're looking at about probably a December payment of about $185,000, depending upon what Billy Woods does. And I have no idea what his intentions are in terms of lump sum or no lump sum. And then Lee Winston's is a little over $400,000 at the end of December, so. So we know we're going to have that the first couple weeks of January. So the two of those together is about just under $600,000.
Have we got paperwork for Wayne Green?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Wayne, he took a lump sum going into the drop, and he's been in the drop since July. And then he has tendered his retirement papers as of the end of November.
So the motion can be authorizing Larry to do a cash disbursement for the drop?
Yeah, to direct us where to disperse it from for drop payout.
Okay, I'll make that motion.
Okay.
I'll second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Take off your shoe at work for Nikita Christian.
Okay. It's a little before my time.
That's going back in.
That's going back a long way.
Early 60s. I saw him do it.
I was out in the yard on my bicycle.
All right. What else?
That's all I have.
Clinker? Still no?
Clinker? Last I heard, he was working at FedEx.
They haven't had any success?
No.
Or what are they trying to do?
FedEx won't play ball.
FedEx will not confirm that he's employed there.
So in fact, you don't know if they talked to
somebody in HR. Dodd. I don't know who they talked to.
Dodd's a security guy out there. He's an MCSO cop.
Okay.
I don't know whether I could reach out to him and ask him a question.
Well, I'm about to.
Here's my question. Are we able to, I mean, I obviously know who Clinker is. What are we able to do as far as staking out?
You're deputized. I'm deputized. And if either one of us had a set of those papers in our hand that were the true and efficient thing and walked up and whacked him in the chest with it, he's served.
Careful with the whacking in the chest, because the police frown on that kind of activity. It's paper. It's still confusing.
But the process server sat out there for what, 4 hours one day?
Yeah.
And they won't confirm. They confirmed that they have a Clinker working there, but not a Matthew.
But the challenge for that process server is he doesn't know who Matt Clinker is.
Yeah, he's got photographs off of Facebook. And
I mean, I get it.
And when,
I mean, it's got to be one of us that's worked with him for a number of years.
You got 100 people getting off shift. Yeah.
They all come out of there at 9 o'clock in the morning.
When his truck is parked in the sister's driveway and he don't live there.
He lives there. I know he lives there. And cops sometimes spot those people looking for him too. So if you know someone's waiting for you, take the back way out or something.
What's it cost to get the sheriff's office to do it? $40?
Well, we're paying a process server that much.
Huh?
We're paying a process server that much.
Why can't we get the sheriff's office to do it? Because they ain't going to turn the sheriff's office away.
I don't know. But I can certainly inquire.
Like I said,
do we not have... It is...
We have a deputy. He's a deputy.
I'm just disappointed the military is not cooperating.
They've been very uncooperative.
That's kind of surprising. I've been on credit issues like that. Dude.
He's supposedly still stationed
out of
Camp Bland. They used to be, what I understand. And they've been very uncooperative.
I actually was talking with a military guy last week, and he said, compared to when he went in 25 years ago, he goes, yeah, if you got your credit messed up, your CO would sit on you and go, write a check for $112, write a check. He said they don't care anymore. Anything else?
Nope.
Anybody? Alright, well, the time is now 14:40, and that will close the meeting.
Okay.